The headlines: Israeli forces kill at least three Palestinians during a night raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. The EU's rights agency warns that the coronavirus pandemic has had an unprecedented effect on human rights, fueling racism and child abuse. And also, the reports the world's highest single-day death toll from COVID-19 after a big eastern state revised its total coronavirus-related fatalities. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Palestinian factions have slammed the Israeli regime for its latest onslaught in the occupied West Bank that left at least three people dead. In a statement, the Palestinian Authority warned that Israel's continued violation of rights would fuel more violence. Hamas and Fatah movements also condemned the raid and stressed the need for resistance against the regime's atrocities. Meanwhile, people took to the streets of the city of Jenin to express their anger at the overnight raid. There, two of those killed were intelligence officers from the Fatah movement, while the third victim was a member of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement. An Israeli soldier was also reportedly killed in the exchange of fire. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more details on the Israeli overnight raid in Jenin.
Well, what's known as the Yemen border police counter-terrorism, this is what is called by the Israeli authorities, raided Jenin in order to conduct arrest Palestinians known for being wanted for security reasons. This means that those Palestinians are engaged in anti-Israel operations or activities or anything against the Israeli occupation. Our sources there said the Israeli forces took with them a Palestinian vehicle, and inside it there was Palestinians. Later it was revealed that one of the Palestinians who were wanted by the Israelis succumbed to his injuries, and he is Jamil Al-Amouri. He was a Palestinian activist belonging to Saraya Al-Quds from the Jihad movement. However, there are reports saying another Palestinian from the Jihad movement had been arrested during the operation, and we are speaking about a third Palestinian officer who is still in hospital in very serious conditions. Today, the funeral of those Palestinians would be taking place in Jenin. However, the funeral of the third Palestinian, of course, cannot take place, as the Israeli forces would remain keeping the body of the Palestinian from the Jihad movement.
In occupied Jerusalem, Al-Quds, Israeli forces have attacked Palestinians protesting against the regime's eviction plan. The incident took place outside an Israeli court, where a hearing was held on an appeal filed by two Palestinian families facing forced displacement from their homes in Silwan district. Palestinians had held a sit-in there in solidarity with the families. Israeli forces reportedly arrested three protesters after beating them up. An Israeli court ruled in 2020 to forcibly evict seven Palestinian families in Silwan to pave the way for settlement construction. The ruling was part of the regime's land-grab policy. In recent weeks, tensions have been running high in the occupied territories over the regime's eviction plans in several neighborhoods, including Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah. Palestinian activist Amal Wahdan joins us now from Ramallah. Ms. Wahdan, welcome to the program. First of all, give us your thoughts on the protests that are taking place against the eviction plans and the harsh crackdown that the Israeli regime has had in response to those demonstrations.
These protests actually is a continuation of the protests that started about 6 weeks ago back. And the Jerusalemite, the Palestinian citizens of these homes, have decided that they're going to fight until the end. And the Israelis know this. So the protest is in line with the with the demonstrations and oppositions against even the court taking place, because these homes belong to the Palestinians for several years back. So the current escalation means that the Israelis are in, are continuing to incite the Palestinians and pressure them to continue their policy of ethnic cleansing. It's a crime against international law and against the Geneva Convention, but the Israelis do not consider any of the regulations or laws by the UN or by the Geneva Convention. So the last, actually the last escalation, the last during the holy month of Ramadan, which led to an armed escalation, again a war against Gaza, and then rockets fired against Israeli targets, was actually, or has actually started because of the court rules and the escalations by the Israeli police against the Sheikh Jarrah residents. So now the Israelis seems not to care at all about the reaction by the Palestinians who are not intending to leave their homes. Silwan, a quarter, is actually outside the walls of old Jerusalem. And they are intending to create a biblical park in the same areas, which means that hundreds of Palestinian families are going to be forcefully evicted or ethnically cleansed from their homes. And this will escalate the situation again. I think that the government of Netanyahu continue to do so because they reflecting their internal conflicts among themselves against the Palestinians to divert direction to other places. So this is a conflict that most of the right-wing parties are in line with. No difference between the government that was led by Netanyahu or is led by Netanyahu or the new government that's going to be sworn in the in their parliament this Sunday. They are all right-wing terrorist governments that's going to be in line with one thing: evacuating Palestinians, ethnically cleansing Palestinians, and crushing the resistance, which will not happen. The Palestinians know for sure that they have this only land for them, and they're not going to leave it without fight. And the fight is going to be furious. We were worried that the March of the Flags, as they call it, which was supposed to be today, and postponed next Thursday, the postponement didn't mean that they canceled it because they wanted to reduce the escalation there, the tensions in Jerusalem. On the contrary, they rescheduled it, which means that raids to Al-Aqsa Mosque, which started early this morning, will continue until Tuesday, where they're going to have their flag march, as they call it. So this tension will continue, and the escalation will continue. The Palestinian will continue also to fight for their rights in Jerusalem and for their rights in historic Palestine as well.
Thanks a lot. Palestinian activist Amal Wahdon speaking to us from Ramallah. Moving on, the European Union's rights agency says the coronavirus pandemic has had an unprecedented and profound effect on human rights, calling for action by European countries. In its annual report, the EU Agency for Fundamental Rights says the pandemic and its reactions have exacerbated the challenges and inequalities, especially affecting vulnerable groups. The report says the racist and xenophobic incidents have increased since the past year. Targeting migrants and refugees, these groups are said to be at high risk of contamination. The report also highlights a rise and domestic violence and sexual abuse, including online child abuse, in 2020. The Vienna-based agency has urged countries to take measures to tackle the pandemic and its challenges to human rights. The report covers 27 EU members as well as North Macedonia and Serbia. India has reported the world's highest daily coronavirus death toll with 6,148 fatalities in the past 24 hours. The record deaths push India's confirmed fatalities to nearly 360,000. That after the state of Bihar revised its tally, adding 4,000 more deaths. The country's health ministry has also announced over 94,000 new COVID cases. With that, the total caseload in India surges past 29 million. India has been struggling with an aggressive new wave of COVID-19 for the past 2 months. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped contain the coronavirus surge. But the South Asian country remains the second worst affected in the world after the United States in terms of infections. Our New Delhi correspondent Munawar Zaman says a severe shortage of coronavirus vaccines is India's biggest challenge these days.
The country has recorded around 6,200 deaths, which is something highest the country has ever recorded. So yes, that's the area of concern. That's the biggest concern that is always there, because we in India, they want to make sure that the death toll remains as low as they can. But as we know that the problem is with the healthcare facilities, there were oxygen problems, and of course the ventilator problems, the vaccination shortage. But in a lump sum, yes, there seems to be on ground, there seems to be a drastic change. The country has started unlocking in several states. Several states have announced the unlocking procedure with the guidelines as well. They're not opening up instantly. They have started opening up in phases to make sure that they keep the COVID pandemic in check. Now, the biggest challenge that the country is facing right now is vaccinating its people, when the country is facing a huge shortage of vaccine. And the government is aiming at opening up vaccination program from the June 21, in which they have set targets to vaccinate every citizen above the age of 18. But many experts believe that this is going to be a phenomenal and a tremendous task for the country, because there is a lot of shortage of vaccination and the country's population is also massive.
Myanmar's military junta has brought new corruption cases against deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other former officials from her government. According to the state media, the cases are related to alleged misuse of land for a charitable foundation, which Suu Kyi chaired, as well as earlier charges of accepting money and gold. These are the latest in a series of charges brought against her. Suu Kyi's supporters say the cases are politically motivated. She was overthrown in a military coup on February the 1st. The army accused the ruling party of voter fraud in November elections, a charge rejected by the previous election commission and international monitors. Dozens of people have been killed and hundreds of others have been jailed during protests against the military junta. Phil Robertson, the Deputy Asia Director of Human Rights Watch, says Myanmar's military is using excessive force to crack down on peaceful protesters.
Our assessment right now is that the Myanmar military is using excessive and lethal force in a systematic way against peaceful protesters all across the country. This is an ongoing human rights disaster, and the government is trying to cover this up with games being played, like charging Aung San Suu Kyi with various different criminal charges. These are charges that, in our view, are politically motivated, that really don't have much evidence to stand on, and will ultimately be heard by courts which are not independent. That the government, the military junta, to be exact, controls these courts and essentially will dictate what the courts come out with in terms of a final verdict. Quite clearly, there is a plan afoot by the Myanmar military junta to put Aung San Suu Kyi and her compatriots back behind bars, and possibly quite clearly, I think, to ban the National League for Democracy political party.
Peru's presidential candidate Pedro Castillo has claimed victory in Sunday's runoff before the official announcement of a winner. Far-left trade unionist Castillo says his party observers considered his triumph a done deal. This is while the National Office of Electoral Processes says vote counting is still underway. Castillo is currently ahead with a thin lead of 50.19%. over his right-wing rival Keiko Fujimori was secured 49.8%. Election authorities say the process will likely take 10 to 12 days to be fully resolved as votes have been challenged by both sides. Fujimori has already alleged fraud in the runoff, while Castillo has urged election authorities to protect the vote. Whoever wins will take over an economy battered by corruption and the COVID-19 pandemic. In Mexico, the ruling Morena Party has retained control of the parliament in midterm elections. Many describe the vote as a referendum on the country's president. Wyatt Reed has more.
The Morena Party of Mexican President López Obrador emerged victorious in the largest elections in the nation's history, a result which he said left him feeling, quote, happy, happy, happy.
Significa tener garantizado.
This means that the budget's been secured, and to be more specific and detailed, it means the budget's been secured for the most needy, for the poor.
Along with their allies, Morena took home between 265 and 292 of the 500 seats in the lower house of Congress. Though the vote did mark a reduction in the coalition's strength, both within the Chamber of Deputies and in the capital of Mexico City, it seems their gains elsewhere more than make up for the losses.
Corporate media have portrayed the results of the election as a significant defeat for President López Obrador. But the race for governorships tells a different story. Of the 15 seats up for grabs, his Morena party came away with 11 of them, despite holding just one previously.
The president went on to cheer the results as a win, not just for his movement, but for the country's burgeoning democratic institutions.
I feel very satisfied because, look, if things had been done like they were before, this wouldn't have been the result. Remember what it was like before, 90 to 10%, because the entire state apparatus was used.
Just 2 days later, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris met with President López Obrador and heralded what she called, quote, a new era between the United States and Mexico, after a discussion that reportedly focused on border security and the country's response to the COVID pandemic. For those looking to wrest control of the government away from AMLO and undo his efforts to transform Mexico, both the meeting and the election were further reminders that after just 3 years in office, the president and his party are very much the dominant political force in the country. Wyatt Reed, Mexico City.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz.
We do not consider American promises to be valid. Lack of trust in the US. When we said that they should lift the sanctions first, I heard some politicians in the world say, it does not make any difference who should begin first. You say that the Americans should begin first, and the Americans say you should begin first. The issue is not about who should begin first. The issue is that during the Obama administration, we trusted the Americans and we did what we were supposed to do on the basis of the Barjam. But they did not honor their commitments. On paper, they said that the sanctions had been lifted, but their agents said to every country willing to sign a contract with us, it is dangerous. It is risky because it is not clear what will happen. In other words, they frightened the investors. That is how they acted. We do not trust them and their promises are of no value to us. The Americans made a mistake in the way they behaved towards us. The Americans, unfortunately, are delusional about all regional matters. In the present time, too, they are making mistakes. Their oppressive support for Zionist regime is wrong. Their cruel presence in Syria, their extensive presence east of the Euphrates, is definitely wrong. Their cooperation with the Saudis in striking the oppressed people of Yemen is definitely wrong. The issue of Palestine will never be forgotten. Their policies on Palestine are wrong policies as well. The issue of Palestine will never be forgotten in the world of Islam. They are taking delight in that a few handful of small governments normalized relations with the Zionist regime. However, these few governments are of no consequence. The Islamic Ummah will not forget the issue of Palestine and will not let go of it. The Americans should know this. The Saudis' failure in making the Yemenis surrender. The same is true of the issue of Yemen. The transgression against Yemen began during the Democratic administration before Trump. In other words, it was not Trump who waged the Yemen war. The Saudis waged the Yemen war during the Democratic administration of Obama.
It was a march that never happened on the occupied territories. Israeli settlers were supposed to hold a flags march in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds, but it looked like as soon as the flags march was announced, it was cancelled. The reason? Hamas threatened to activate its missiles. All this was preceded by warnings and threats issued by the Palestinian resistance, where the head of Hamas in the Gaza Strip, Yahya Sinwar, stressed that if the confrontation with Israel erupts again, the shape of the Middle East will be different from what it is now. Sinwar stressed that the resistance is able to achieve deterrence and was able to make possible the accumulated force. Based on the order of how the announcement was then rescinded, after Hamas made this threat, it appears that Israel has surrendered to Hamas. This conclusion is also based on Israel's loss to the Palestinian resistance faction's victory over the Israeli regime recently in the 11-day war. Israel had to surrender, stop the war, and then go to Egypt to broker a permanent ceasefire. The U.S. administration also weighed in and called on Israel not to take steps that would ignite the situation in Jerusalem.
To say that there's a permanent ceasefire, I think, is dreaming. There has never been a permanent ceasefire. And there won't be one until the siege ends and the occupation ends and there's justice for Palestinians. So again, I think that that is really hyperbole. I do believe that the U.S. pressured Israel and said, you have done enough and time to stop. But again, we've seen this pattern over and over and over again. And so I am not particularly optimistic. I think there was also pressure because of the issue around the different parties trying to coalesce around toppling Netanyahu, and that fed into the outcome.
The situation in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds remains tense, especially in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. From forced evictions to the detainment of activists, the occupied neighborhood remains a tinderbox. Most recently, Israel detained a prominent female Palestinian activist in a raid on her home in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Mona al-Kord leads the Safe Jarrah campaign. It's a campaign which has been trying to mobilize actions against Israel's plan to displace dozens of Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. She was released days later, but the evictions still continue, and hence the violent clashes between Palestinian resistance and Israeli occupying forces. Israel has been under heavy pressure from the resistance groups in Gaza and Lebanon. Days ago, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah Resistance Movement, warned Israel that any aggression on holy sites in the occupied Jerusalem al-Quds would lead to regional war and destruction of the Tel Aviv regime.
Well, I do think that attacks on Al-Aqsa Mosque are incredibly dangerous and would ignite a tremendous amount of rage amongst Muslims all over the world, and potentially a regional war. And I think it is very important that Israel not do this, and it would be catastrophic. Again, I cannot emphasize enough that Israel is a massive military power with nuclear weapons, with U.S. backing, and there have been many instances of the past where Arab nations have threatened to, quote, destroy Israel, and they have been quite unsuccessful. So I think we have to be very realistic in terms of the level of military might that Israel has, given the history of the region.
Furthermore, a report has revealed that both Hamas and Hezbollah chiefs had discussed a plan for the liberation of all Palestine. This was discussed last year and prior to the 11-day war. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza war was part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during 2006 war by setting up marked rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. Yemen's Ansarullah also communicated with Hamas and requested coordinates for the site it wanted to target with missiles and drones, but Hamas told the popular movement not to intervene as long as the Israeli army had not crossed the red lines. Now, with a new cabinet being formed in Israel, this should serve as warning to the incoming administration to make sure the rights of Palestinians will not be violated and Palestinians will be allowed to pray in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinians, however, are not holding their breath. They are rest assured, however, that resistance groups like Hamas and Hezbollah have their backs.
Tensions are growing between the West and Belarus after Minsk scrambled a fighter jet to divert the flight path of a Lithuania-bound Ryanair passenger plane and forced it to land late last month. Minutes after the landing, Belarusian authorities arrested 26-year-old opposition blogger Roman Protasevich and his fiancée who were on the plane. The move infuriated the European Union and the United States.
And Belarus used its control over its airspace in order to perpetrate a state hijacking. Therefore, the safety and security of flights through Belarus airspace can no longer be trusted.
During a summit in Brussels, EU leaders urged carriers based on the bloc to avoid flying over Belarus. In addition, they have agreed to ban Belarusian airlines from using the bloc's airspace and airports. The 27-nation bloc has slammed more economic sanctions on Belarus. The EU says it has indefinitely frozen a 3 billion euro investment package for the country. Minsk's move has been slammed by some EU leaders as, quote, state piracy.
Essentially, Belarus is very highly aligned to Russia, and that is the choice that they made. Well, this doesn't sit well with U.S. imperialist efforts who want to see all essentially all countries in the world allied to them and subservient to them. Now, this is part of a larger U.S. strategy to try to encircle Russia within Europe. As we know that the current Ukrainian crisis is going on right now, where NATO-aligned forces are going to be fighting Russian-aligned and full-on Russian forces probably sometime in mid-June when the permafrost finally melts and it's more advantageous to move large vehicles across Ukraine. Belarus is allied to Russia.
Belarus says it requested the emergency landing due to a suspected bomb threat on the plane. The airliner then left Minsk for its destination in Lithuania shortly after. In a video broadcast by Belarusian state media, Roman Protasevich said he was in good health and cooperating with the country's officials.
Hello, my name is Roman Protasevich. I was detained yesterday at the Minsk National Airport. I'm now in the Minsk Detention Center number 1. I can say that I don't have any health issues, including heart or any other organs disease. Police officers treat me properly and according to the law. Also, I now continue to cooperate with the investigation and give a confession on organizing mass protests in Minsk.
The opposition was quick to reject the statement, arguing that Protasevich was confessing under duress. But Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has denied any wrongdoing, accusing the West of seeking to provoke unrest in his country. In a meeting with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, Lukashenko said the West is trying to, quote, rock the boat to cause a new round of protests against his government. He was referring to the outbreak of protests after the 2020 presidential election when his opponent and Western countries accused his government of voter fraud. President Putin has also warned the West against meddling in Belarus's internal affairs. He also dismissed speculations that Russia participated in diverting the airliner.
This isn't simply someone being targeted by a country for, you know, whatever reason. There is a very clear process here. Person is wanted for a crime, and if they pass through the country, then they are going to be stopped. I mean, this is not even comparable to, say, the Chinese Huawei CFO who was stopped in Canada for a crime that doesn't even exist there.
The recent incident wasn't the first that led to rising tensions between the West and Belarus, which is in a union state with Russia, and will certainly not be the last.
Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations. The UN says 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from famine. Yemen has struggled with mass outbreaks of infectious diseases, and poverty has surged to affect as much as 78% of the population since 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional states launched a devastating war on Yemen. The U.S. and several other Western countries have participated in the war by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi coalition. The United Nations says the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused an estimated 233,000 deaths, including 131,000 from an indirect cause such as lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. Meanwhile, the World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. While the results of the US-sponsored Saudi aggression on Yemen speak for themselves, Washington is trying to push a narrative that the Ansar Allah movement is mostly to blame for the ongoing problems in Yemen, not Saudi Arabia. After returning from a trip to some Arab states of the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, accused Ansarullah of refusing a proposed ceasefire. However, the movement has consistently participated in peace talks with the Saudis and allies of former Saudi-backed government. The main reason for the failure of previous peace talks was that the Saudis refused any deal involving power sharing or a fresh election. That's why the Saudi-enforced war on Yemen was aimed at bringing the Saudi-backed former regime to power and crush the popular Ansarullah movement. Despite years of ongoing aggression against Yemenis and spending billions of dollars, Saudi Arabia and its supporter, the U.S., have been unable to defeat the popular Ansarullah movement, and the recent willingness to negotiate a truce proves their weakened position.
The U.S. Narrative should be ignored because it has nothing to do with reality or truth. The people of Yemen continue to suffer because of U.S. actions, because of U.S. sending weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Ansarullah movement has nothing to do with, they're defending the people of Yemen, certainly, but they are not the reason for the war. It is Saudi aggression financed by the United States that is the reason for the war.
The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen has accused Yemen's Ansarullah movement of not trying to reach an urgently needed ceasefire in the war-torn country. That's why the Biden administration has refused to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen, which is a key Ansarullah condition for a ceasefire. The Saudi-enforced blockade has caused a lack of food and medicine. Meanwhile, the Ansarullah movement, as well as activists and international aid groups, have been calling on Riyadh to separate the blockade from the negotiations and not use the suffering of ordinary Yemenis as a bargaining chip. Moreover, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has tried to show itself as a so-called impartial mediator, trying to resolve the ongoing conflict in Yemen. For instance, in February, the Biden administration announced that the United States was ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen. But Biden said Washington will continue to help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty and land. Washington's so-called defensive support for Riyadh includes providing maintenance services to Saudi Arabia's warplanes that are bombing Yemen.
When Joe Biden became president, he made some statements about no longer financing the war in Yemen, no longer supporting it, but he continues to send arms to Saudi Arabia. Now, he calls these defensive, but that's not what they're used for. As long as the profits continue to flow to the United States, the government doesn't care who's dying. The U.S. government doesn't care whose blood is flowing, whose children are suffering and dying, as long as the profits continue to accrue to the United States. So that's what's happening now. Biden can say that he doesn't support the war anymore, but continues to send armaments that are being used in that war. So it's complete hypocrisy, which is typical for the United States. It's an ongoing, unfortunate tradition with the United States, and it's not going to stop under Joe Biden.
Washington previously announced it is halting its support for offensive Saudi-led operations in Yemen, but the U.S. is still helping Saudis in the Yemen war. Furthermore, Washington has refrained from holding Saudi Arabia accountable for the current crisis in Yemen as it has refused to pressure Riyadh into lifting the blockade on Yemen or to end its aggression. And that is a clear sign of the U.S. shielding of Saudi Arabia and Washington's contribution to this war.
Iran's Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, "Taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states." He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, "economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees. He accused the United States of attempting to mass starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions. The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says the country has regularly paid its UN membership contributions during the past years, despite unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran, which have made financial transactions difficult for the Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Tehran has been in talks with the UN Treasury to settle the debt. He also urged the world body to introduce a self-transaction channel after the U.S. blocked the previous channels used by the Islamic Republic to transfer money. The foreign ministry spokesman said Iran has proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, five member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned, no stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness.
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate the conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impacts of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via internet
our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Previously, we were looking at the juridical system of Islam compared to the juridical systems in the Western courts. Islam says that it doesn't matter your position. If you face an Islamic judge, Islamic jurist, he shall judge based on what Islam seems and deems to be correct. So the judge himself will not take into consideration who you are, where you come from, and where your position is. So if you face a judge, you could be the president of the state, you could be the king of the state, or you could be the servant of someone in that state. And Islam says you all have to be dealt with and judged equally. There's a story of a person called Jubla ibn al-Ayham. He was a known person back in the pagan era, and then he became a Muslim. And he was a Christian, then he became a Muslim later on. One day, Jubla ibn al-Ayham was circulating around the Kaaba, and Ayham was a sort of a king of his own people, of his own tribe. He was, you know, he had a position in his own tribe. One person stepped on his cloth as he was walking. So Ibn al-Ayham got a bit upset, and he hit that person on the face. How dare you step on my cloth? So this person went to the Khalifa of his time, and he complained. So this Khalifa of his time, he brought Ibn al-Ayham and said to him, "How did you do? Why would you do so? Why did you stab this person? And you know, we have to take the right of that person from you." In a way or another, obviously, whether he apologizes to that person or the person has to slap him in return. So Ibn al-Ayham, he got offended. He said, "Me, I'm a leader of my tribe. I'm a person of status. You trying to bring me with a common person who I slapped and trying to take rights from me? How does that work?" And the Khalifa of that time said to him, "You know what? You and him became equal since both of you submitted and accepted Islam. End of the line. That's it. Since me and you, whether you're a king or not, accepted Islam, that makes us equal. That if you hit me, I have the right to take my rights from you. Either you apologize to me and I'm happy with it, or either you pay your dues. So Ibn al-Ayyam, he said to the Khalifa, said to him, you know what, give me time, let me think about this. And a few days later, this guy disappears and he ended up in Rome and he went back to Christianity. He changed his faith completely because he had so much pride and arrogance that he could not find it in himself to apologize to a person that he took his wife because he thinks he has a higher status. Where Allah says, that does not work with me. You're both the same. So some might say, well, wasn't this a little bit harsh, this kind of a judgment? Couldn't be dealt in a nicer, more flexible, more softer manner? You know, just, you know, tell the guy, this poor guy, look, he didn't mean it, and just let it go, walk away, it's all good. Shouldn't this has happened instead of, you know, being taking this to an extreme and the guy has to leave Islam and so on and so forth? I will answer this question right after the break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. Just before the break, we were talking about the story of Ibn al-Ayham, who slapped a person as he was doing circulation to the Kaaba because he stepped on his cloth. And the Khalifa wanted to take the right from him, so he fled to another country, to Rome, and he became a Christian again. So we said, isn't that a little bit harsh? Shouldn't they would have been nicer to him, kinder, gentler, more gentle to him, so he would keep his faith? What we need to understand and keep in mind that the laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, first and foremost, applies to all, whether you're a king or not king. We cannot make exceptions on the expense of Islamic laws. Because if I make this exception to this person, and he makes an exception to that person, then the Islamic laws itself will collapse. That's one. Two, we need to make it known to everybody that if you do wrong, the right or justice will be applied to you. And this is the message that we need to push to generations to come. We see oppression happens after Islam and until our current day. It's only because most of these Islamic laws, they were changed because they weren't applied. Because the kings and rulers of the time, they used to, oppress people, take their right and apply the laws based on what they see fit. They would take the money from people and taxes from people. They don't give anything back. And they take that wealth and they give it to their relatives, for example, and give it to those who are close to them, and so on and so forth. So these ahkam, these laws were changed, were abandoned, because those who were in power were not applying it. So we say, no, if something like this happens, the law needs to take place. Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter what status you have, the law needs to take place. So in this story that we said, that this is the message we're trying to push to the ages and to the generations to come, that Islam does not differentiate between a person who is a king or his tribe, he's a king of his tribe or leader of his tribe, and a common person. The laws need to be applied. Now, if he still lives in the pagan mentality that how dare they, oh, how could they do this to me, or I am the boss, well, that's just a wrong mentality that no Muslim should have, or no human being should have, as we established earlier, because at the end of the day, we're all equal. So what if you got a title before your name? You're a doctor, professor, fulan. At the end of the day, you're just like me. If no one knows your title, you mean nothing. Without the paper that you have achieved, you are nothing. When you die, you mean nothing. Your titles and your wealth all remain here. So you have a king who is buried next to a poor person. So at the end of the day, titles means nothing. And if we uphold the Islamic law correctly, we will give the correct message. to our kids and to generations to come, that regardless of who you are and your position, the Islamic law will apply to you nevertheless. All you have to do is face it, not run away from it, accept it. So if this person would have apologized to that poor man, everything would have been over and he would have delivered a beautiful message to us and to the generations. But rather his arrogance changed everything around and made him flee Islam altogether, which Allahu A'lam, he might have to face the wrath of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
The United Arab Emirates, one of the major gold trading hubs in the world. Yet two decades ago, the country was not even among the world's top 100 gold importing countries. But how can a country with no gold mines or history become a global center for this shining metal in such a short period of time? The answer to this question would shed light on some of the darkest corners of the businesses inside the UAE. With no local gold to use, the Emiratis import gold from wherever they can. In 2016, the UAE imported the valuable metal from more than 100 countries, mainly located in Africa, South America, or South Asia. Many of these countries are known for artisanal and small-scale gold mining, ASGM. In some corners of the world, such as the Democratic Republic of Congo and Sudan, ASGM gold is sometimes mined and sold by illegal armed groups. It might be involved in grave human rights violations, child labor, illegal exportation, and smuggling.
When you talk about Democratic Republic of Congo, where gold, a lot of gold has been mined over the years, talk about Central African Republic, it's still a country that has been unstable. If you go to Sudan also, because of the civil war, that made the country break into two countries. So we have Sudan and then we have South Sudan. All these countries that are dealing with mining, you find that these countries experiencing political instability does not really provide a chance for any regulatory authority to check what's happening.
Since it's difficult, if not impossible, to assure the clean origins of ASGM gold, reputable gold refiners usually avoid it altogether. In Dubai, however, ASGM gold is usually sold in the Emirates Gold Souk. The Emirati dealers accept gold originating from any country, regardless of the production circumstances. This lack of due diligence explains the UAE's rapid rise as a major global gold hub.
We know UAE was for a long time very well known in terms of oil production, which has been going on for a long time. But of course, as time have been changing, then we had situation whereby oil production and also revenues generated from oil production started to dwindle, become smaller and smaller. And therefore, I think which is the right thing to do, it was within the government of UAE to think of how to diversify their economy. And therefore, gold became a very attractive alternative.
Gold imports rose by 58% per annum to more than $27 billion in 2018, according to data collated by